This is a poem called In, the title poem in my book, Ecstatic and the Poison. In. When we first heard from blocks away the fog truck's blustery roar, we dropped our toys, leapt from our meals, and scrambled out the door into an evening briefly fuzzy. We yearn to be transformed, translated past confining flesh to disembodied spirit. We swarmed in thick smoke, taking human form, before we blurred again, turned vague and then invisible in temporary heaven. Freed of bodies by the fog, we laughed, we sang, we shouted. We were our voices, nothing more. Voice was all we wanted. The white clouds tumbled down our streets, pursued by spellbound children who chased the most distorting clouds, ecstatic in the poison.
Andrew, as you mentioned, that's the title poem from the collection Ecstatic in the Poison, which also has a great cover photo of a young child out in the middle of this DDT poison.
Yeah.
Where did you find that, and how did you go about locating the image that you wanted to go with that poem? I can't imagine actually being able to find it.
Well, you know, I did that when I was a kid. I mean, have you done that? When I was a kid in North Carolina, for mosquito season, these big trucks would come. Well, they actually weren't that big. The trucks would come down the street with these big smoke makers on them, and we just called them smoke truck or the fog truck. And I didn't know that I knew they were there to kill mosquitoes, but it somehow didn't click into my head that it was poison, you know? And so we all did it. I mean, we would literally run away from the dinner table, and our parents thought, okay, that's cool, because we weren't asking for money to buy popsicles. And so I hadn't thought about it for years, you know? And then I ended up writing this poem about it when it suddenly clicked. We loved it. It was great. So when the book was done, I thought, well, golly, I wonder if you can get a picture of that. And I spent hours in the library. I didn't know you could do image database searches. And I went to the reference library and learned how to do that. And then I ended up back at home doing, you know, Google image searches and things like that. And under the keyword, finally, I figured out the right keyword was DDT, not fog or poison or truck. I found this photograph, and it's from, I think, the early 50s, from the National, what is it, NOAA, National Oceanographic Atmospheric Administration or something like that. I remembered having to memorize that when I was a kid, but obviously I've forgotten it. And I suggested it to Overlook, and they tracked down the rights on it, and I think it was probably minimal since it's a government photograph. And I, you know, it's one of those things where the photograph really is what the book's about, so it's kind of fun.
The kid really does look ecstatic in the poison on the front. I can see a little Andrew standing there. And you have two interesting quotes right at the beginning of this book. One from Wallace Stevens and the other one from Miss Alabama. Balance that out.
Well, I'll read them. This is from Stevens, from one of Stevens' poems. If ever the search for a tranquil belief should end, the future must stop emerging out of the past, out of what is full of us. Yet the search and the future emerging out of us seem to be one. And he's talking about, you know, obviously a conception of the future determined by a human movement, and history as having a purpose to it, which we tend not to think nowadays, I suppose. And this one is supposedly from Miss Alabama at the 1994 Miss Universe pageant. Question: if you could live forever, would you, and why? Answer: I would not live forever, because we should not live forever, because if we were supposed to live forever, then we would live forever, but we cannot live forever, which is why I would not live forever. And you can hear somebody, you know, flustered trying to answer one of those questions without getting in trouble, trying to think and not being terribly good at it, and yet also working within the confines of, you know, some kind of biblical upbringing. And it didn't at base seem entirely different from what Stevens was saying. And, you know, that was something I saw on one of those internet joke lists. And, you know, what people say, you know, if it's not true, it should be. And they did kind of capture, you know, the serious side of the thing, and yet the kind of human she gets the kind of human desperation underneath, you know, our desire for immortality. And so I thought they balanced off.
They're definitely interesting start to the book. And then the first poem you read is In, and then the book is divided into three sections and ends with a poem called Out.
Yes.
And how do you decide on those sections within those poems? I mean, is there, I'm sure there's some kind of organization within your mind as to how those poems all fit together.
They do. Well, in the first section, the In section, I see the speaker working his way into the world, and then in the middle section, you're there. And in the third section, we start moving back toward out. And into conceptions of the world, into creations of the world through artistic projects, I guess is really what I'm thinking about more than the world itself. That was the organization that kind of fell out as I was looking through this material.
Would you mind reading a poem from that first section?
Okay. The Cadillac in the Attic. After the tenant moved out, died, disappeared, the stories vary, the landlord walked downstairs, bemused, and told his wife, "There's a Cadillac in the attic." And there was, an old one, sure, and one with sloppy paint, bald tires, and orange rust chewing at the rocker panels, but still in all, a Cadillac in the attic. He'd battled transmission, chassis, engine block, even the huge bench seats, up the folding chairs, heaved them through the trap door, and rebuilt a Cadillac in the attic. Why'd he do it, we asked. But we know why. For the reasons we would do it. For the looks of astonishment he'd never see, but could imagine. For the joke, a Cadillac in the attic. And for the meaning, though we aren't sure what it means. And of course, he did it for pleasure. The pleasure on his lips of all those short vowels and three hard clicks, the Cadillac in the attic.
It certainly does make a nice sound, but why would anyone ever decide to put a Cadillac in the attic? You know, you talk about the meaning there. What is the meaning?
Well, the joke is kind of the meaning. This is a story I'd read about in a memoir of... it was from a book, a tribute to Don Justice, and one of the people that was remembered was this character who had done this. And it sounded like the kind of thing you hear about, you know, a folk myth or urban legend. And it just seemed like a fun thing to do. And I then started thinking about, you know, somebody who's so dedicated to the joke that you really have to work at it day after day and month after month for the consequence that you'll never see, you know? And it seemed almost like a parable of creating art. You know, and yet you ultimately do it for the pleasure, and then you do it so you can tell people you did it, you know, and it just seemed kind of like a terrific thing to think about. And the more I thought about it, the more I kind of fell in love with that phrase, the Cadillac in the attic, and how cool it sounded, you know. So it was one of those things where there was pleasure and something serious also going on at the same time underneath what just seemed like a good practical joke.
And the first time I read it, it always reminded me of that Johnny Cash song, you know, the one piece
at
a time.
Oh, sure, one piece at a time.
Where it spins the Cadillac parts and then ends up with the freak Cadillac at the end.
Yeah, exactly so. I actually, that had flitted through my brain at one point when I was thinking about this.
Yeah, that's what happened. How about day job and night job?
Day job and night job. After my night job, I sat in class and ate every 13 minutes an orange peanut butter cracker. Bright grease adorned my notes. At noon, I rushed to my day job and pushed a broom enough to keep the boss calm, if not happy. In a hiding place walled off by bolts of calico and serge, I read my masters and copied Dunn, Marlowe, Dickinson, and Frost, scrawling the words I envied, so my hand could move as theirs had moved, and learn, outside of logic, how the masters wrote. But why? Words would never heal the sick, feed the hungry, clothe the naked, blah, blah, blah. Why couldn't I be practical, Dad asked, and study law, or take a single business class? I stewed on what and why, till driving into work one day, a burger on my thigh and a sweating Coke between my knees, I yelled, because I want to, pained, thrilled, as I looked down from somewhere in the blue and saw beneath my chastened gaze another slack romantic chasing his heart like an unleashed dog chasing a pickup truck. And then I spilled my Coke. In sugar, I sat and fought a smirk. I could see my new life clear before me. It looked the same, like work.
And that's an argument a lot of young writers will hear is, what are you really going to do with this? You know, what are you doing for society? What are you doing with this writing? Are you just sitting around enjoying yourself? And a lot of people don't realize that it is actually serious work.
It's work. It's funny, whenever I think of college, the first thing I think of is those little orange peanut butter crackers.
I love the preciseness of that. It's like every 13 minutes I ate one.
Didn't you do that in a class where you were bored and you'd go, I can have one after 13 minutes. Then I have to wait for another 13 minutes.
That's right. You're hearing absolutely nothing of what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was, but I was also, and then if you did that, then you would have to get a hit on the Coke you were drinking with them, you know, and you're trying to keep them at the same pace because that was breakfast, you know, and because I was rushing from a job that I did at night to one that I did during the day, and I just didn't have time to, you know, go back to my folks' house and get something to eat. And then, of course, when I'd have those notes and when I'd study them, they'd have a little, you know, kind of yellowy stains all over them. But, and so, in, you know, you're working hard, and being a poet seems like this indulgence, when in fact, it too is work. Mm-hmm. It's a different kind of work. It's not a remunerative work. Certainly not for the first 10 or 15 years, but it's what you want to do. It's what you want to do. So you do the things that you have to do the things that you want to do, which is a different form of work. And, you know, and it was true. I mean, I actually, my day job was working at a dry goods wholesaler, and they would have these bolts of cloth in there, and he also had these big towers of shelving, old plywood shelving units, and you could use the steps as a ladder, climb up to the top, which was probably about 3 stories, because up off the ground inside this building, and I would form the bolts of calico into a little fort up there on the top, and I could hide there. Nobody would find me.
Make an appearance every once in a while to look like you're doing something.
Yeah,
and hide
yeah,
the fort.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
been there, not exactly,
but there's something like that.
That's
yeah.
correct. And it is funny how many writers always their jobs actually that they had in college because or before or after because you bounce from job to job to job. A lot of the times, especially if you don't decide to teach right off the bat,
yeah.
And you see that pop up from time to time in people's writing. It's always
sure.
interesting to see the type of jobs people have had.
I just jump into this poem called "The Ship Made for Burning." For 10 days while he was in the ground, we women sewed rich garments for him. We men drank night and day and made for him a ship made for burning. And we asked his girl slaves, who will die with him? And I said, I. And we 2 attendants groomed her and washed her feet. What did you do when your father left the earth? And I, who am the slave girl, drank and sang and gave myself to leisure. When the ship was made, we removed the Lord's corpse from the earth. We dressed him in soft boots, a caftan studded with gold buttons, and we propped him on a cushion in the ship and surrounded him with meat, his blades, his dog. We each lay with the slave girl, and we each said, "Tell your master I've done this for love of him." What did you do when your mother left the earth? I made that vow to each man as he left me. They raised me over the door frame, and I said, "Behold, I see my mother and my father." And they lowered me and raised me again, and I said, "I see my ancestors seated at the feast." And they lowered me and raised me again, and I said, "I see my master seated in paradise, and paradise is beautiful and green. He calls me, take me." What did you do when your brother left the earth? They carried me into the pavilion with my master, and thick with sweet beer, I lay against his chest, as I had lain when he was yet alive, though never for an entire night, never receiving the whole of his great warmth, not being his wife, but neither was I his body slave, she who merely washed his gray hair, cooked his meat, and scraped the day's sweat from him. I bore him children. What will the living do when you pass on? And we strangled her, and stabbed her, and burned the ship made for burning, launched it on red waves, and we drank as it burned down to cinder and ash beyond the reach of insects. And we raised a birch post, and wrote the name of the Rus king on it, and we departed.
That's a very intense poem, especially when you sit and contemplate what's going on there.
Mm-hmm.
The story, you know, especially of the king and the details of the stabbing and the, and he's been in the ground 10 days and she's laying, you know, it's just, but then you contrasted the we, you've got the we part of the story going on there. And then the you, like, what did you do with your father and your mother?
Right.
How did you come up with that vehicle that you had going?
I'd been thinking about it's based on a literal description of a Viking funeral from the Middle Ages. And thinking of just the story itself at first and what seems a strange burial ceremony to us. And what was most interesting to me was the slave girl who's going to die with the master. I mean, her body, she's going to die and be sent to greet the master in paradise. And that sense of a permanency in paradise, the ephemerality of our life, and the different characters. And I don't know, I mean, I was just thinking my way into it, and no, I wanted not just her point of view, but their point of view, the one who's leaving and those who are going to be left, and everyone having their sense of their place in this world and their obligations. And then in a way, it's not really that different from what we do. It's raw. It's more immediate. You're right there. And we're not distanced from death the way that we are. But we still ritualize death in many of the same ways. We're simply cut off from seeing what goes on in the funeral home with the corpses. And
you don't really want to know either.
I actually do, but I'm always fascinated by things like that, and I don't know, and so I was quite fascinated by it, you know, and I, as I wrote it, I got interested in her voice too, you know, the people that she's contrasted to the rest of them, the ones speaking as we in a kind of a group voice, are interesting, playing that group voice of those left behind and the individual voice of the one who's been chosen to pass over interested me too.
And what a title, The Ship Made for Burning, just to sit around and think about it. That's an excellent title. I like that.
Oh, thanks. It is, again, that artifact, well, what's the phrase, the self-consuming artifact, you know, when you talk about art. And that seemed to me an example of it. Mm-hmm. And that thing that you make for the purpose of destroying, but the making and the destroying create a certain act, you know, a crucial ritual act.
That's probably what I like about it. Another thing in there, there's a lot of, in that poem, I know you had chosen a story and were studying the story, but there's a lot of violence in there, in that poem. And if you look at a lot of your other poems in here, it seems like it's in there too. Like there's Southern literature and there's a couple mm-hmm. other poems in there. Do you think that the creative act is somewhat violent, or is there violence on your mind, or do you even see a connection there?
I agree with you. People see an act of creation as a benign thing, and it isn't always, and in often it's not. It something that's new destroys certain ways of looking at the world and things. But it's also true that I'm horrified of violence, so I think about it a lot. People who grew up, if at least somewhat connected to the rural world, know violence in a way that a lot of people don't. And I suppose actually people living in certain, you know, inner city places know it too, in a different kind of violence. But violence was not only, it was a bad thing, but also it was just, you know, people got their own meat. You know, you saw, you know, animals brought in, animals raised to be killed, animals that people went out and hunted. That was a normal part of life.
Blood on your hands regularly.
Yeah, exactly. And so those things are not, you know, they are connected. And I was both fascinated by it and horrified by it. And so I've thought about it a lot. And also just Southerners find humor in violence, too, in a way, I think, from that closeness. And it's that sense of a certain sense of horror and also a certain sense of relief, a certain kind of fatalism that comes out. And it's like once somebody's been hurt a little bit, but not terribly, then it's funny because we know the worst, the other thing could have happened.
Right.
And I mean, other rural cultures know this too. I mean, we're not, you know, our sense of humor is, I don't think, that different from a Russian sense of humor, for instance. But I also know that things that I routinely think of funny horrify Northerners. some.
Right. And the poem I mentioned, I believe, was Southern literature. Would you mind reading that one? That's
okay.